Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Profiling Evil Podcasts, Cults Among Us. Today, I'm talking with Kristen Decker, a woman who grew up in polygamy. Kristen has devoted the last 20 years of her life helping survivors of polygamy and patriarchal abuse. So let's talk Cults Among Us. Kristen, welcome to Profiling Evil. I'm so grateful that you took time to come out and talk to me today.
Hey, Mike. Glad to be here.
You know, I have to say, you, in my opinion, are an amazing person. I think back on, after reading parts of your book, and I haven't made it all the way through yet, but I've made it through enough to really understand a lot of at least your up to teenage years. You endured a lot of abuse as a child, and you then endured many more as a polygamist wife in a patriarchal, destructive belief system. And, you know, I have been chided at times for the way in which I sometimes describe some of my experiences dealing in polygamist groups, my perceptions sometimes where I talk about the negative aspects of a polygamist lifestyle. And I try to always preface my comments that I'm an outsider looking in, but my opinions were always expressed based on interviews I did with those who were on the inside, who were living it, who were participating. But I am really looking forward to learning more from you today, and I want to start by asking you just to tell everybody a little bit about who you are and the belief system, polygamy.
Well, there's so much to say. We could speak for hours. I was born and raised in polygamy. I'm sixth generation polygamist. My sixth great grandfather knew Joseph Smith and therefore believed in polygamy. And my brother who does the genealogy said out of all those grandfathers that the in between my father and his father that only two of them actually lived polygamy, but they were believers that this was required of God. And so the day I was born, I'm sure the day I was conceived, Mom started indoctrinating me into this. I'm the youngest of her eight children. I'm number 11 of my father's 23. And that's a small family compared to many, many other polygamous people, leaders especially. My father was considered the prophet for 28 years of the AUB, Apostolic United Brethren. And my mom was, I think I mentioned that, first of 13 wives. While I was growing up, my dad had four wives. The year I got married, he married his fifth wife and had children with those five women. And then after that, women married him who were older women and had children before with other partners. But he, over the years, had 13 living wives and many, many more that have been sealed to him for the hereafter. So,
now, did all of the wives of your father live under the same roof, or were they in different households?
When I was young, we lived really close together. When I was born in one of the other mother's homes, little tiny one up the street, and then my mom lived in the basement house that my dad had built. It was literally a basement with the roof on that. And then when I was I think 11 or 12, dad built the upstairs. My mother moved up there and another wife moved downstairs. And the one that was there supposed to be taking care of me moved up in the little greenhouse, we called it. But we all lived really close and together for a little while.
And how did you differentiate, or did you differentiate between moms? I mean, you were fortunate, I would think, having your mother be number one in that family unit. But was everybody mom, or was there a designation that really identified your mother as your biological mother?
Yes, my mom was a legal wife, and so she was Vera Allred, and my father Owen Allred. And then the other moms' wives would keep their maiden names, and those children went to school by those names. So they were Aunt Eleanor and Aunt so-and-so, and the names, you know, it was always Aunt, and that was our neighborhood and the whole group's belief is just call them Aunt. And so over the years, some of my brothers started calling them Mother, you know, Eleanor, Mother, so-and-so, and giving them a name, a title that way. But growing up, they were all our aunts. And my siblings that were all my same age because of other wives, we all went to high school and they had different names, but they were cousins. So that's so supposedly cousins. Yeah.
You were in a unique situation compared to, I've been talking a little bit about my experiences with the FLDS and the AUB, the Apostolic United Brethren, were living more in mainstream populations. What was that like?
We called the area we grew up in Pliggyville, and that was okay for us to say that. But others called us Plague Kids, or if they called it Pliggyville, you know how that goes, then that's offensive. It was like we could say it jokingly because that's who we were. But we grew up where the Fashion Place Mall is right there in Murray. And it was huge amount of property that my dad's second wife's father gave to him, donated to him. And he had a big chunk. My Uncle Marvin had a big, huge piece. And my Uncle Lyman, who was married to my Aunt Beth, we had big community there, but it was really open at the time. And then the subdivisions all started building around us. And most of us went to public schools, and we weren't supposed to socialize. The rules were to go home and hang out with our own families and not really make friends in school, and to avoid them because they were going to lead us astray. And that wasn't good. And also we were afraid of them because they were the wicked outsiders and going to lead us astray. So we were to avoid them, you know, and that's pretty much how I was raised.
That had to have been so confusing, though, when your heart is identifying with a friend and you want to play with that friend, associate with them. There's something about their personality that you connect with, and yet you got this thing that's haunting you, peering over your shoulder saying, be careful because they're evil and represent the outside world. What a challenge for a child.
It was very challenging, but I would say even more so was back in when I was younger, the kids were mean to us anyway. And that solidified that, that they were bad kids or that they weren't going to be nice to us anyway. For the most part, we were treated, you know, called names and thrown rocks at us sometimes and just avoided. For those that their parents would say, don't hang out with those kids, same thing. They were told we were bad or evil or would lead them astray or talk them into becoming polygamous. And so, yeah, and my brothers, and I'll tell you a little more about that as we go, but they were supposed to convert girls to the group because there weren't enough back then relatives. We were all related. And at that time, we were not supposed to marry relatives, of course, in the AUB or the Allred group. That changed quite some time ago. But back then, my brothers were busy trying to convert their girlfriends and make girlfriends and find wives. So it was very confusing and crazy.
Yeah. And I might be getting ahead of myself here, so I'm going to just ask this and maybe it becomes a tease for later as we talk. But wasn't that almost counterproductive to say we've got to recruit because we don't have enough people to keep this thing going? And was the purpose keep it going because this is a righteous movement that needs to move forward? Or was it because of lustful feelings of men who wanted more wives than one? Is that fair to ask?
I would say it goes both ways. There were definitely believers. I believe with all my heart that my dad and his dad and my uncles really believed this was a commandment of God and that they had to live plural marriage in order to have their salvation and have other worlds, and that this was required of them. And they did believe this with all their heart. And they taught that from the time we were very, very young. But I know too that it drew polygamy, the community drew perpetrators, drew them in. And there were a lot of men who might have even been born into it who became perpetrators. There were, for sure. I think the nature or the evil or whatever, I hate to even say that, but there's all these children that are available and a lot of women, and there weren't enough. And so the guys were the ones who had, my brothers, who had to go recruit women. The girls were not to recruit the guys that were already going to be married to somebody in the group. And there's both believers. There's definitely believers, and there's some really sick people that it draws and converts people to.
Well, so Kristen, maybe you could help our listeners understand a little more about, and I'm going to kind of lay the groundwork for this, of what really fueled the division between the mainstream Latter-day Saint faith and the polygamous communities. And it goes back to the very early years, in fact, the early 1900s, when the Latter-day Saint leadership of the official church said that polygamy would no longer be practiced. And folks, for those of you who often wonder and watch TV and still believe today that the members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints are polygamists, there was a clear division that occurred in the early 1900s where, because of law and the challenges, the mainstream Latter-day Saint faith said no more. It has not been legalized in Utah. It has been decriminalized. And that's a really important thing, because a lot of times, Kristen, people think, well, Utah's just said, hey, let's go for it, and let's go for it. But polygamy continued in each of these groups that initially broke off from what became, I believe, the FLDS group, and then the AUB, and this group of seven kind of started splitting off. But maybe you could just give everyone a quick history of what the belief system is of polygamy.
You bet. My understanding and growing up with this history is that when the manifesto, the LDS Church, the second manifesto, and even before that, there were all these believers in plural marriage that had gone on, like I said, for generations, for us, six generations in our family, that polygamy was required, that it must be lived, and therefore you can't end it. Fundamentalists gathered, the ones that were already living, that believed that that wasn't okay. They called themselves the Council of Friends. And they just met in people's homes and continued to preach, you know, about what they needed to do, and that we had to have wives and we had to have all these children and we could not stop this no matter what. They looked at the LDS Church as being out of line. My father described it as a separation between a husband and a wife, and claiming that the people who continued plural marriage held the priesthood, and so that would be the father or the patriarch, and the mother church was the wife who was to continue to keep the social part and the functioning part going and keep things running well. And they were to continue to live plural marriage outside of the LDS Church. And so they kept that going. They hung together a lot of years. And then about 1945, there was a police action. I hate to call them raids, because I know that they're behind the scenes were these good intentions, which was to rescue women and children and to try to end something that I would call perverted. But, you know, you call it a raid, and so that gives it this really negative connotation there too. But since me learning more, I've decided that, well, hi, Ivy. And so the purpose was, like you just said, main thing was to keep polygamy going and to make sure that all these women had a whole bunch of kids and that this was the calling. They looked at, I was raised thinking or being told that our little group and the polygamists were the righteous, you know, the real Mormons, the ones living all the gospel and all the, and I didn't like that at all. I never felt any better than anybody else, and it was puzzling to me. But the separation between the FLDS and AUB came along with a lot of doctrinal problems that were taking place in 45 and in, again in 53, and child bride marriages and so forth, and intermarrying. So for a long time, the groups would teach, they were trading brides. My oldest sister was married off at 13 years old into the FLDS community to a man who had two wives already. And she, and then, I mean, as I've left, I found out that even though the Allred group or the AUB taught that that was inappropriate or wrong, that my Uncle Rulin had child brides. And you just learn all the crazy making things about the past and what's really taking place. And it's also controversial and crazy. Now I'm getting way off.
Well, no. And I'm going to bring us back on track, but I want to mention, and it became deadly when you spoke of your Uncle Rulin.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's for sure. He was murdered in his office. So what happened was, and I did jump way ahead, I have a tendency to do that, is the group split up, and then there's more splits and more splits and more demigods. Everybody's claiming that they have this authority and that they're called of God and that they have the priesthood, and they, and all these break off groups of polygamists and fundamentalists, and the LeBaron, Irville LeBaron sends two of his young wives to into my Uncle Rulin's office, and they kill him. They shoot him in Murray. And it's just really insanity.
Is, and it was from the outside looking in, it was insanity, but I'm sure that on the inside looking at what was going on, it was completely unbelievable, especially when it reaches murder. You experienced the harsh realities of being born and raised in polygamy, and I hope harsh realities isn't a mean-spirited way of saying that. Your father led the second largest polygamous group in America. We talked about that already, the Apostolic United Brethren. And I think you and I have talked about the fact I knew your father. I spent days on site during my tenure with the Attorney General's office. Now, he was much older by that point. But can you talk a little bit about your childhood and what it was like just day to day growing up? Because there had to have been great times too, weren't there?
The best part was, and the worst part, the best part was I was a latchkey kid, being the youngest of my mother's eight children, and never knowing who was supposed to be taking care of me or who was in charge. Or I just feel like I pretty much raised myself. So that was really cool in the sense that I was a tomboy and I could go hang out with all the brothers and anybody who would let me, you know, participate. The boys were all chauvinists, so I was a girl, and I'm not supposed to play football or soccer or whatever, but I played in the river and with the snakes and frogs and the toads with some of my cousins that were brothers and their friends, and just had a good time. And I ran like crazy. I was just totally outdoors. So that was my happiness. That was my joy. Trying to be home in the house was a whole different story. Most of the time we didn't know what meals were, where food was, who was supposed, you know, my Aunt Eleanor, who lived downstairs, was the favored wife. She was a second wife, and she's a favored wife. And there was always food on the table and always, you know, her family sitting around the table in the care. And she made sure dad was there. She insisted, well, my mom was at work helping to support the family and turning in all the money. And the aunts and uncles that were all in the neighborhood had their huge families. So they would just send me home and send me away. So I didn't belong. I didn't have any self-esteem, probably unkept, never even learned what it was like to brush my teeth or clean or do any of those things. I learned everything just from observing everyone else. And older kids are supposed to be watching us. And so therefore, I was a victim of sexual abuse, like I found out most of my siblings were, and especially the girls, the younger ones. I thought, like all victims, that we're the only ones. And when dad would leave, he would say, all right, your brother so-and-so has the priesthood. He's the oldest one of the priesthood. So you obey him and you do what they say, you know, that sort of thing. And he's in charge. And then so you do that, whatever they say, with the threats or the, you know, you're in trouble too if you say anything. And a lot of people talk about the abuse and the fear coming from the outside, but I've always felt more afraid on the inside than outside. Even the mean kids at school, I don't think I was so afraid of them as I was some of the doctor who molested me and the brother and the cousin and people like that. It was like not safe outside and it wasn't safe inside is how I felt. So of course I ran away, stayed outside and away as long as I possibly could. Pretty much raising myself.
As you transitioned into the teenage years, I think about my wife was a junior high choir teacher, 8,500 kids, teenage in every class. Those are the most confusing years in a human being's life, is that teenage period of time. Now the added pressure of your body physically maturing and getting attention. I mean, and it sounds like that abuse started earlier, but what was this like during your teenage years and the, I would think, realities of?
Yeah, that was a challenge. And what I didn't say that I'd like to throw in was not only being home and being molested if my mom and dad weren't there, which was most of the time. My mom was really depressed most of her life too. And I call it miserable happiness. And I saw my mom escape through books. And they were usually the religious books that kept her tied into her belief system. And she would say, we should be crying or sad or angry a lot. And she would say, it's not the gospel that's wrong. It's me. If I was a better person, if I would behave, if I would only stop feeling jealous, if I would only pray harder, you know, she would condemn herself. And so she would always tell me that we should suffer and endure to the end, no matter what, because the blessings will be greater in heaven. So when I'd watch her suffer, she was enduring, and that's what she was telling me. I'm going to stay. I'm going to do what God requires me to do, no matter how hard it is. And that was her message to me all the time. And so if I'm seeing her cry, it's like, I'm fine. I'm just having a bad day. Everything's okay. And don't you think that it's, you know, this or that or the other. It's me. I'm the one who's bad. And she would fight with my dad, and he would walk out, she would cry, and then she'd tell me that again. And it's because I'm defective, and not that her jealousy or that her heartache was justified. It was all wicked and wrong. And that's so, it was miserable happiness. She was really happy thinking she was serving God. And she was miserable doing it. And she taught me that and my siblings that. And that was the overall message, that it didn't matter how hard it is or how crazy making it is. And so when Uncle Roland was killed and all these horrible things are happening, we're all thinking, well, this is just God's way of testing us. We're going to see how faithful we can stay and how long we can endure. And that was the overall message.
I just find that so interesting. And I want to return to this a little bit as we start talking about when it was your time and your turn to be the mother. And if you then replicated those same words with your children. So we're going to get back to that. But folks, I'm speaking with Kristen Decker, a woman who grew up in polygamy. She knows what polygamists believe in and how they live and what some of them, perhaps most of them, experience. Kristen has devoted the last 20 years helping survivors of polygamy and patriarchal abuse. Now, Kristen, you were thrust into marriage. Was this something that was exciting, or were you terrified when you were told who you would be marrying?
Actually, in the AUB, in the Allard group, most of us had chose our partners. So it was different than the FLDS community where there was assignments. The toughest part of that was that we were supposed to find and pray to the only one person that we're supposed to marry. Of course, women, one. And I was related to everybody. And then the converts that came into the group were all older men with wives already. And I had never wanted to live polygamy. I just knew I had to. That's how it was going to be. You know, you're playing dolls and you're pretending that there's all these other wives, and that's, you know, the system of training. And so I'm knowing or believing that this is what I have to do. I have to be a plural wife. But for some reason, I was like, no way am I going to marry an old man. And I'm not going to marry a guy who's got another wife. I will find somebody who's not related. And we were doing roller skating parties, and my brothers were dating girls from other groups, independent groups. So they belong to other groups, or they're not really following any. And there's a lot of independent, we call them. They don't have specific leaders or prophets. They're just living polygamy, and that's their belief system. And so I met my husband, who was dating my friends, and I was dating his friend, and we weren't supposed to date. We made it like we were just all hanging out. But the guy I was dating was too chauvinist for me. I guess somewhere inside of me, I had this wild spirit that my sister said, Kristen, you were always rebellious. And I said, I was. I complied with everything. She'd go, yeah, but inside you were rebellious. I was like, okay, that fits. Yes, thank goodness. So anyway, I met my best friend. I would talk about my boyfriend. He would talk about his girlfriend, which was my friend. They were friends. And we became best friends. And this one day I'm thinking, I guess I cannot wait till I'm 18, because then I'll be an old maid. We all have to be married before we're 18. So I better hurry up and make this decision. And geez, this guy's kind. He's a nice guy. He's my best friend. We hang out all the time. And so he must be the right guy. You know, oh, and by the way, the God I grew up with, I did not trust at all. He was mean, just horrible, wrathful, punishing. Because also, my mom told me if I was a good girl, bad things wouldn't happen. If I stayed in places that were holy places, bad things wouldn't happen, and that God would protect me if I said my prayers and if I did all these things. Well, that wasn't happening. And so I just decided God didn't like me, and I didn't know why. And later, when things were getting worse, God hated me, and I still didn't know why. So I just didn't trust this God at all. And so it was going to be, I had to go by what I felt my soul would tell me. And thank goodness, my soul kept saying, you're a good person, and you're okay, and you're going to make it, and everything's fine. And when I would listen. But back to the guy. So I had told Mom, we were sitting on the couch, and he proposed to me. I mean, many times he'd ask. And finally, I said, yeah. And he goes, you will? I go, yeah. So it was my birthday. We're going to go out. I tell my mom we're going to go out for my birthday. We're walking out the door. And Mom loses it. She gets really mad. She said, you didn't ask me. You can't just tell me you're going and you didn't ask me. And I said, Mom, I've never had to ask you. I don't get what you're talking about. What's this? I was just blown away. And she lost it because I think it hurt her so bad to know she hadn't been there to raise me. And it was offensive to her. And I didn't mean it that way, but she just lost it. And she grounded me. And then I thought, boy, it's a good thing I'm getting out of this house. I'm getting married. I'm out of here. So that was how I decided to hurry up and get married before I turned 18. So.
Wow. So help everybody understand this evolution you went through once you were married. What were your concerns for yourself? And what became your concerns for your children as you had more children and time passed? What was all that like?
Wow. Having children was the thing we were told women are supposed to do. And I wanted children. I always, always, always loved kids. I loved playing with them and pretended I was the teacher. And I loved babysitting and loved my nieces and nephews and planned on having a whole bunch of kids. But I knew I was going to have to live plural marriage. The belief system said I had to. And in fact, now that I've got kids, I don't even get to have them in heaven if I don't live plural marriage. So I've got to make sure that my husband gets, other wives. And he and I got along really well. I think that we were really falling in love, even though we were friends. He was in love with me and I was falling in love with him. And so as time goes by and he's flirting with other girls and I'm knowing we need to do this and it's just breaking my heart, stabbing pain. And he would flirt with other young girls and I would just cry. And then finally, I'm watching all the people my age, other girls getting sister wives and everybody's acting like they're happy, which is another put thing. You see the smiling faces and you think, oh, everybody's just happy. I guess if they're doing it, then I can do this. Everybody, no one dares talk about the real feelings because, like I said, women are bad if they're jealous. They're defective. They're supposed to get over all this stuff and just be happy and put on the smiling face and keep sweet. So anyway, I decide that there's my second cousin who's got a crush on my husband who'd been dating her sister. That was my friend. And I really liked her. I thought she's a darling person. And I realized that she had a lot in common with my husband. They liked the same music and she was funny and she was cute. Okay, if I have to do this, then it's at least somebody I like. So I started encouraging him in that direction. And things moved forward. She sent me an invitation to her wedding with my husband. And she invited me to dinner at her place and she and my husband sat on the couch and made out and I lost it. I thought I was going to die and went on a long walk. And then at the wedding, I put on the smiling face that's required of all women and said yes, took her hand and put it in his hand and passed the test in flying colors. Why, I'm so good and I did this so brave. And yet inside of me, I was dying. My heart was breaking. I thought I was going to throw up. I don't know how I really stood there and put on this good show that we were all required to do. And I remember thinking that if all the older women in the group were to watch me do that, how proud they would be, because we'd been told all of our lives that you just have to keep sweet and do these things. And the better you do it, the judgment is really harsh. I remember my mom looking around one day and complaining because another couple that had just taken another wife. And my mom says, wow, she's doing really good. She's really keeping sweet and she's really doing a good job there. And then people would make comments about women who were crying or angry, which wasn't okay, negative comments. So there's just, women are the toughest on the women because we're all, I don't know why, I guess the men get mad and angry about it, but we have to keep each other in line because I don't even know where that comes from. It was just gossipy. I guess that's what it is. It was just gossipy. But I remember that night is when I finally lost it. And I thought I was just going to die of pain while they went on the honeymoon, that I didn't have, it didn't matter. I mean, even if I'd had one, it was still going to hurt horrible. And then she moved in downstairs when they came home, and hearing the sounds made me want to commit suicide. And it's crazy. It's just crazy making. I think what I had to do is not think, I know, I just became numb, a workaholic. And that's what women do. And in fact, I realized that that's why we had so many kids and why it's okay to have so many kids. And we'd convince ourselves, and the women would call it baby hungry. Oh, I'm baby hungry, which is sick, you thinking back on it. It was our way of being so busy with the babies and the kids and our minds off of what our husbands are doing or not doing or where they're at or what they're doing and not, you know, that it just, the more we had to do to keep busy, the more we could keep our minds off of what was going on somewhere else. And I know that for me and many other women, that that's part of why we're so willing to have so many children, which was crazy making. Raising my kids in that was also really hard and really sad. My husband, being an independent, didn't feel that he had to comply with the rules of a congregation. You know, he didn't have to go to church. He didn't have to pay tithing. He didn't have to read the scriptures. He didn't have to gather for prayer. He didn't have to get me to heaven. He was independent, and he'd been raised that way. And he claimed that he had just as much priesthood and authority to do his decisions about our house than anybody else did. And so I didn't believe for a long time that he was going to get me to heaven. So we argued about those things and argued about church. So a lot of times, most of the time, I went to church by myself, unless he wanted another wife, or unless he met somebody that was at church, or unless, you know, those kinds of things. It was real sporadic. So I really loved this guy because I think he was a good guy, but he wasn't the one my dad would have picked, and he wasn't the one who was religious enough to, in my opinion, you know, back then, to get me to heaven. And but meanwhile, that I'm like, no way I want my kids doing this and living this way. It's crazy and it's hard. And my sister wife and I got along. We weren't best friends because I don't believe really that anybody really is. I think it's another requirement of women that you are best friends, or that you act like you're best friends and you put on the smiling face. But we only had one argument, and it was hilarious, really. But we just kind of lived our own lives. I had my friends and she had hers, and she had her family and I had my family. And
well, hey, folks, we're going to return to this interview with Kristen Decker in a minute. But I wanted to pause and remind you about my book, Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult. Deceived explores cult behaviors and cult dynamics, just like those that we're talking about. It chronicles my investigation and ultimate takedown of a religious cult that committed more than 4,000 assaults against adult women and children before I led this team of 60 officers when we raided the compound one early summer morning. In all, we arrested and convicted 12 predators. But the real story is about some of the 32 child survivors who rose above the abuse. The book explores cult recruiting tactics and how seemingly intelligent people can be convinced to commit crime. You can get signed hardbound copies of Deceived at ProfilingEvil.com, or you can get paperback or ebook versions of the book on Amazon. But now, let's get back to my discussion with Kristen Decker. So, Kristen, you finally reached a point where you were able to escape that situation and That led to therapy, college, eventually divorce. Why don't you talk through this journey of how you finally said enough is enough, recognizing that you would lose some things that were very dear to you, but you had to make that decision. Let's talk about that.
I was already, like I said, questioning everything. I always questioned everything. And I had questioned my parents many times about two or three men in the group on my dad's council who gave me the creeps. And it finally came out that they had been sexually molesting their own children as well as many other people over the years in the name of God. And they got excommunicated only because some of the girls threatened to go public if something wasn't done about it. And in all those years, my dad and mom had told me, I was wrong. Your feelings are wrong. You know, you need to fast and pray and get a better spirit and a better, you know, testimony, because these men have been called of God. And I think that was the bottom line for me. After many other questions, that was it. As called of God, and even Uncle Rulin didn't know that, and my dad didn't know that, and I believe Joseph Musser, who called one of them, didn't know that. I don't buy that. So that was really the clincher for me. And I wanted to stay in the marriage. And I felt like my husband and I were finally getting on the same plane and doing well. And I wanted to go to school and get my teaching degree. And so I started. Oh, I'm going to back up a titch about the therapy. My daughter was running away and doing crazy, wild things. And she got picked up finally. And the judge said she had to have therapy and home arrest and whatever else. It's in my book. And he points at me and he says, you too. And I'm like, wait a minute. Do you get to demand what happens to me? But I remember thinking, oh, really? Maybe that would be good. You know, maybe, just maybe. And so I stayed with the therapist for a couple of years, and my daughter did her required amount of time and ditched. And she's doing really well. Amazing, by the way. But that woman was a lifesaver to me. And I didn't have a clue who I was. I'm ready to leave. And she asked me, what do you want to be? And I said, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do. And through processing, instead of who I was told I had to be, I have to figure out who and what I really me. And so that was a long, crazy, fun process. And I always did, like I say, want to be a teacher. So I decided I was going to go to school. And with six kids at home, I went over to the community college and then took a break for a while, tried to do a business, which didn't work. And that's a long story. Then I ended up going to SU and getting my teaching degree and graduated the year I turned 50. Oh, I back up a titch again. I was teaching Head Start off and on. I loved that for, I think, off and on for maybe 9 years. And it was fantastic. So I went there, came home. My husband talked me into trying to come back and make this marriage work. Meanwhile, he has a girlfriend who was running the show. And I'm like, no way. But I stayed too long with that. I just wanted to slap me. It's like, what were you thinking? I just kept giving him more and more chances, which is crazy making. But I finally ditched that. And it was such a relief. It was hard, but it was a relief. And yes, everybody, his family, nobody's talking to me. I'm evil. The lies start. They throw you under the bus, literally. You become this evil, wicked person. Everything that's bad, I was accused of. And it was very hurtful. I had brothers and sisters who wouldn't talk to me, friends who ditched me, a lot of relatives. Some do, some don't. Two of my own sons didn't talk to me for a long time. It's really tough to leave, but I had to do that. And when I left, I started teaching and met the most wonderful man. His daughter was cooking at the school I was teaching at and said I needed to meet him. And as resistant as I was, I finally said, okay, I'll meet him. Doesn't mean I'm going to do it dating, you know, whatever. So we started dating, been together almost 15 years now. He's precious. I think I married the best man in the whole world, and he's awesome. And we moved to Southern Utah because I loved SUU where I got my teaching degree, and he always wanted to move there. So we started working with the Diversity Foundation to help with the lost boys, and precious, amazing. Read up more on that. Warren kicked out 200 and can't remember the exact number, boys all at once. And so, of course, that they could have the young girls, and there's too many boys. And which brings the cruel arithmetic in my presentation with the National Cultic Association. And Deb and I started the Sound Choices Coalition to talk about, or our motto is to inform society about the realities of polygamy and advocate for its victims. And so we still work on that. I can't tell you how many times I've tried to quit. It's so hurtful. As you know, in reading your book, I was speaking about my own book and I talked to people, and then more and more people would come and tell me what they'd been through and their stories and their heartaches and their, I thought my life was bad. It was nothing compared to what so many have been through. And so that's when I decided, I told Deb, we need to talk about this. It needs to be in the open. People need to know what this polygamy really looks like and what's going on. And I've had a lot of hate from doing that too. I'm not an anti-polygamist. These are my family and friends and people and loved ones. But I'm very much anti-polygamy the way it is, at least coercive polygamy, where we feel like we have to or you're going to go straight to hell. And so anyway, I've never been so happy, even though these tears sound sad. When I left, I never had such joy. It was the most freeing feeling ever in the whole world.
So, Kristen, as we've shared experiences back and forth, me asking you questions about experiences I was having as I read your book, 50 Years in Polygamy, you, as you shared feelings you were having reading my book, Deceived, we talked about the emotion, but you shared something really tender to me that I wonder if you would feel comfortable in sharing with the group, and that was when you were invited to go on the popular TV program, Sister Wives, and not so much about some of the dynamics, unless you want to share what some of those dynamics are, but what happened after you did that?
Oh, yeah, I did tell you about that, didn't I? So we had been, the producer had begged me to come and talk, and I didn't want to. And he begged me to because he said, we'll show your side, the anti-polygamy part of plural marriage. And through the whole process, me and the other three young people he invited to participate just kept feeling abused. We kept feeling like that he was trying to incite fights or negative feelings or for him to get us to, drama. To bring up a lot of drama in it. And I brought up being sexually molested, and he'd say, well, who did that? And I'd say a name, and he'd say, well, did they get charged? Well, you can't put that in. Did you say that? Oh, well, did they ever do anything? Did the police arrest them? Well, no, we aren't putting that in. Otherwise, I kept feeling he was calling me a liar. It was really tough. I didn't get time to speak at all. They gave me maybe 2 minutes. And in the whole end process, which was supposed to take place at the college. And then when I was leaving, I was right behind someone else who heard the producer say something extremely negative about not getting what they want and how are we going to make this happen. I don't remember all the words, but overall, about a week of off and on filming. I went to the motel place in Las Vegas where my room. And the next morning, I couldn't get out of bed, and I didn't know that PTSD existed for me. I'd had a lot of therapy and years of being out and years of recovery. And I just felt like nothing I did or said was what we were promised, and it was going to be all twisted and turned around. And I don't even know that my brain was working. I just couldn't function. And I had an episode of what other people experience as PTSD. I was gone and I was crying and I couldn't get up and I couldn't get dressed. And I'd go back in bed and curl up in a ball and cry. And I felt lost. I didn't even know where I was. And finally, after doing that for a couple hours, I called my friend and asked her to come and get me and talk to me, because I was just losing it. And I don't know how to explain it. It was just weird. I felt that we had been abused through that whole process of getting their show, what they wanted to put out there, however they were going to interpret it. And then when it came out, there were so many deceitful situations in there that didn't even take place. And I don't know how they manipulated that. A bathroom scene where they're trying to make me look like I was haunting and stalking Christine. And that was so uncalled for. It was pathetic. And then there was another one where Robin picks up her phone and says, made it look like we had texted something really mean and derogatory about Cody being a misogynist pig, or, you know, they said, and, you know, just things like that. And I went, yeah, it's no wonder we felt that way. We really were. All of us felt really violated in many ways during that process.
Well, I'm so sorry. And I can't imagine how inopportune those flashbacks and memories are. This post-traumatic stress disorder is real. And having dealt with people who have gone through horrendous things in their lives, not as a therapist, but as the police officer who got to pick up the pieces and try to build a case, I can say that it's real. And I'm just so sorry that you do that. And you probably find yourself at times driving down the road and all of a sudden something just triggers you. We'll hear from people who listen to this podcast today, Kristen, and they will say, you said something that triggered me and put me into a funk. And we just pray for them that they can work through that. Where can listeners find your book, 50 Years in Polygamy? And can they pay a little more and get it signed from you?
I have about 400-500 books left in my garage. We ordered like 7,000. You can get ebooks online from Amazon, and you can order my book online from Amazon. But if you want it signed, then you can order it from me and I'll send it to you out of my garage.
So. Well, I want to thank Kristen Decker for coming on today's podcast. Please make sure that you check out her book, 50 Years in Polygamy. I'm going to put the link down below. I'm also going to link to her Facebook page, which is the best way to reach out to her. So you'll see both links below. Kristen, thank you so much for taking time to talk today, but I'm going to leave you with the final word before I do a little bit of closeout business. Do you have anything you'd like to end with?
Oh, thank you so much. One of my precious cousins I haven't seen or talked to in 25 years just sent me a text message today. And he says, I cried happy tears when we hung up. And he said, I left. He said it was, oh, I wish I had it handy, really. He said, I left. My whole family left. My kids are out. It was too, I'm paraphrasing. He said it was too crazy. We were choking on the Kool-Aid and we're out. And I started crying. I was so happy. I just wanted to scream. I was like ready to literally scream. And so that's what I love hearing. All I want is for people to have the happiness that I felt since I left, and to wake up and realize that everybody can have this. So thanks so much. Yeah.
Well, folks, these discussions can be really disturbing. So if you or somebody you know is being victimized by destructive behaviors, please get help immediately. There are resources and experts who spend their time helping people in cults. I'm going to be watching for your comments down below on this episode, and I hope that you'll weigh in with your thoughts, your feelings, and your emotions. Make sure you take time to review other people's comments and respond to them. And if you like this episode, please hit that like and subscribe button. Share our Profiling Evil channel with your personal networks. And remember that you can subscribe to Profiling Evil podcasts on your favorite podcast platform. And for those of you who are interested in supporting our efforts here, please consider joining our channel memberships. You can get into it for as little as $1.99 a month, and your contribution helps us pull things off and get things done. Check out our new Profiling Evil Academy. That's my favorite. It opens the door for learning more about the investigation and profiling process, and you can find those links below. So please follow us on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And thanks again for your support. We'll see you all soon at the next crime scene. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.